And here we are, Cinema Squabble, episode number 70. Adam Gerke, Steve Reeder, and Sprince Arbogast joining you this edition, episode number 70. The episode to focus upon Oscars, upon Oscars, upon Oscars. This is the episode Sarah Michelle Gellar really, really, really wanted to be at, but was unfortunate due to unforeseen circumstances, unable to be at the recording with us. So we will have Sarah back, of course we will, for the I Told You So episode. Probably episode 71, as a matter of fact, in a couple of weeks. So bear with us here. In the meantime, we do have a number of films to talk about, and also going to be digging into Oscars, who we think will win and who we think we would rather win, perhaps, as it were. That being the case, let's talk a little bit about a number of this week's films or the ones that came out last week. Topping it all off, let's talk a little bit about Annihilation, a little film that happens to be a sci-fi film brought to us by Alex Garland. Now, Alex Garland, if you may or may not recall, was the individual who put together Ex Machina of a few years ago that kind of turned the sci-fi world back on its ear. Do you recall Ex Machina?
Outstanding. Yeah. It was beautifully done. It was clinical in the best sense of the word, in terms of the story, in terms of the cinematography. Wonderful acting from our leads in that particular one, including Alicia Vikander, which made her a star in the English-speaking world. Just a superb film.
Yeah, and so this, in my eyes, was kind of the reawakening of sci-fi in many regards. We'd seen a lot of attempts at sci-fi and didn't see anything that was really that exciting until Ex Machina. So Alex Garland, writer-director, is back on this, but he has taken the work of Jeff Vandermeer of the book Annihilation, of which I apparently believe there are multiple books in this storyline.
In this canon.
Yeah, I have not read a single one of them. But what I can speak to is what Garland has done is he's taken the nuts and bolts of this. He's put together another sci-fi adventure of sorts where we have this mysterious thing that has landed on Earth, and it is slowly taking over a quadrant of the Florida coastline, starting at a lighthouse, point X. Inside this shimmer that is developed around this object that has landed on Earth, there are changes being made to DNA of individuals or things that are going into or stuck in this shimmer that seems to be expanding outward. And every military group that has gone in, no one has come out, except one, who is a character played by Oscar Isaac. And Oscar Isaac's character happens to come out. His wife happens to be a biologist, Natalie Portman, and she is stumped by this. Before long, she gets whipped up into this whole mystery of how did my husband come back from this thing that we didn't know existed, this government cover-up, and she goes into the thing to figure out what it was that he saw, da-da-da-da, becomes a he said, she said. She's going, kind of following in his footsteps, goes in with Jennifer Jason Leigh, Tessa Thompson, a whole host of other women. So it's the women going into the fog, and I'll leave it at that. Is that a good enough setup?
I think that's also very good, but I would add this. It's interesting, sort of, we almost have genre characters. We have what? We have a linguist, we have a biologist, we have a botanist. I'm trying to think of the other
physicist
in there. Yeah, so we have an interesting array of characters here who are trying to decipher this puzzle and decipher what it means while themselves being transformed through a whole series of genre episodes. In other words, movie, cinematic genre episodes, some associated with sci-fi, some associated with horror, some associated with mystery, some associated with ecological disaster film. And it's this constant churning or transformative effect that we basically get throughout.
I think that's really astute observation on that, because I was saying this is taking English, psychology, sociology. It was sort of the liberal arts degree of film. It took all these things together, mixed them up, and then spit them back out. So I think what you're right, Steve, where it's taking multiple genres, I think that's really actually even more accurate to what we're seeing going on here. Frankly, I'll just come right out and say it. I loved it. I didn't quite know what to make of it at first, but I still walked away from it with more questions and more discussion wanting to happen from it. And I think anytime a film does that to me, it's done something correctly.
I always feel a little bit guilty, Adam, when I have to say this, but you know what? I felt the need to immediately see it a second time, like, mm-hmm. I don't quite grasp all of this.
Yeah.
The enigma may be more than the filmmakers intended. I'm a little bit lost at the end, but my goodness, it was wonderful to have it wash over me. And now I'd like to go back for a second time and sort out some of these threads in the story. But it's beautifully done. And by the way, one of my early nominees for most beautiful cinematography of this calendar year. It's beautifully shot. It's this otherworldly look to this very multi-generic kind of story.
And that's why I actually liked it. Now, I didn't love the film. I liked it a lot. I was scared and nervous and on edge, and I was nervous that I was going to have nightmares that night. I did not, which was good. But I didn't love it as much as you did, Adam. Yeah. But why did you love it? I mean, the cinematography, yes. And I would, I shouldn't say I would go see it in a theater, but.
Yeah. No, you can't. You're fully well within your rights to say that. Here's the thing that makes this different to me than others. When you take sci-fi and you have bad sci-fi, you're able to poke a hole in it very, very quickly, very, very easily when you find the chink in the armor, when you find the flaw, and suddenly the whole theory unravels and you go, nope, it's a piece of crap. In this one, it doesn't really give you that opportunity to say that there's a hole in the armor. The science of it, if you will, there's not much science to it, but the science that's in there does hold up. And therefore, it really does become about the fiction. And so it continues to plant that seed of what if, and it does it in an effective way that you can't just undermine by saying, oh, well, that would never happen. Oh, well, that doesn't work. And that's often what seems to be the Achilles tendon, and this doesn't have that.
And what did work is it did create conversation. I'm still thinking, mm-hmm. what if?
Yeah.
So, yes, it's a wonderful POV picture because you feel like you're immersed, like you're a little adrift, like you're a little bit lost, like you are being transformed in some way, just like this life force and all that it touches and subsumes during the course of the picture. It's wonderfully atmospheric. And to answer your question, Sprints, I like the fact that there is a certain amount of intellect, mm-hmm. a certain amount of science to give this some rigor, some structure, just beyond, you know, my feeling about the story itself in a more general kind of way. Mm-hmm. And so I like that about it.
So theater, rent, skip, Steve?
Absolutely, theater. You got to see it on a big screen.
Yep, yep. And I'm with you on that. Sprints, what's your take on
theater?
This? Theater. Haha, three theaters already off to a strong start. Game Night being another one that has been rounding the bush, if you will. This is Jason Bateman and Rachel McAdams.
Rachel McAdams, yes.
And the general gist being here, you've got a couple. They're highly competitive. They have Game Night with their friends. They happen to be invited to a Game Night by Jason Bateman's older brother, Brooks, who happens to be played by Kyle Chandler. So they go to this Game Night. Turns out it's supposed to be this murder mystery adventure thing. Well, as one thing turns into another, it starts to look more and more like this murder mystery adventure whodunit, real-life clue game, turns out to be the real thing. Only then it becomes this giant MacGuffin, and we're racing across town trying to find the actual criminals, who's the kidnapper, what's going on, and comedy ensues somewhere in the midst of all of this. That's kind of the general gist of Game Night. I'm just going to just come right out and say it and say, you know, I had fun with it. I found it to be a light distraction. It was a fun distraction. Here we are in this is a season when everyone's going out to see Oscar films, trying to get all their Oscar ballots figured out. They're trying to go out and see everything else. There's not a whole lot being added to the mix as far as more cinema other than, or anything that's daring enough to go up against the Black Panther right now and try and make a dime. So, you know, the theater throws in Game Night to try and make a dollar. And does it work? I think it has a few chuckles. It has a few guffaws. I didn't find myself knee slapping and rolling out of the aisles. But good enough for what it's for, like I say, distraction. Thoughts? Sprints?
No, I second that. Plain and simple.
You were not consistently surprised?
No, I enjoyed it. I was just thinking, why would I go see this? When would I go see this mm-hmm. film? And just a fun distraction. I like Jason Bateman, so mm-hmm. movies that he's in, I will just automatically go.
Yeah.
I like his sense of humor.
Agree. I thought Bateman does his usual kind of witty rapport, and in this case, it certainly works. Was I taken away with it? Not quite as much. I do enjoy some of his other characters. I think this one works fine. overall, yeah. I'm going to say it's more of a rental category for me. Sprints, where do you come in on this?
I would say, you know what? I would go to the theater. Again, if you want a fun distraction, go.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, why not?
Wow, we're shelling out the $15 a head for Jason Bateman and Rachel McAdams. On
plus this. Parking.
Okay.
Just don't look at the price of ticket.
Yeah,
the ticket.
Okay, yeah, sure.
We'll dinner before.
We'll catch up on that one later. Okay. That brings us to Red Sparrow. And Steve, you are the only one that had a chance to catch up with this. But I desperately wanted to see this, did not make it due to timing. Do tell.
Well, I'll tell you, it's a real mixed result. Red Sparrow, based on a novel by Jason Matthews, the novel of that title. It's a topical, it's a contemporary sort of let's renew the Cold War story, starring Jennifer Lawrence and an all-star cast. By the way, it's an outstanding cast in this picture. Directed by Francis Lawrence, no relation, whom you may recall from the Hunger Games franchise. Directing here a story about a ballerina at the Bolshoi who suffers a serious injury and finds herself recruited into a very murky world of espionage, sorting out moles, consorting with Americans and the CIA and senatorial aides and all the rest, shot on location in Eastern Europe and shot quite beautifully. I mean, once again, in terms of atmosphere, it's all there. Here's the story. It wants to be a story about empowerment. The Jennifer Lawrence character, whose name is Dominika Egorova, who wants to somehow demonstrate her ability to manipulate men, which is a great idea. It's a wonderful premise, and there are certain individual scenes when it works. But overall, to imagine that this character could survive in a world of espionage seems a little far-fetched. Joel Edgerton, who plays Nate Nash, her CIA contact, they're both, in effect, trying to recruit each other. No spoilers, by the way, so don't worry about that. No spoilers coming here. He seems so... It's such an interior performance by him. It's just flat. And there's just no chemistry between them. And so you don't get that typical expected dimension to an espionage or spy thriller in that respect. There's a little bit more interest with her uncle. Oh, pay attention now. It's a Russian story. Uncle Vanya, thank you, Chekhov, played by the wonderful Belgian actor. I like to think of him as the Belgian Michael Fassbender, Matthias Schoenaerts, who is really excellent. He's cold. He's clinical. He's sinister. He represents what we want him to represent here. But we also have Jeremy Irons as a general in the Soviet Army. We have Kieran Hines. And then, curiously, we have Mary Louise Parker as a senatorial aide who comes across as more than... More ditzy than actually a seriously intelligent or conniving kind of character. Here's the problem. The Jennifer Lawrence character, Dominika, does grow into the role, does come to appreciate her situation, does appreciate that she's been basically forced into this kind of life in order to try to save her mother back home in Moscow. She adores her mother, and basically she must do this. This is the essence of the blackmail. Mm-hmm. But the whole idea of what's at stake and how it's written, and how the characters respond, and how long it takes to tell this story, which is a good 2 hours and 15 minutes, far longer than it needs to be, it leads for a certain amount of redundancy, and it's not really an action-based espionage thriller. So now you're in John le Carré territory. And the level of writing, the level of dialogue, the level of characterization here is just not up to that standard. And so you come away feeling a little bit undernourished dramatically, even though it looks great, and even though Jennifer Lawrence, quite honestly, it's pretty good, and her Russian accent is remarkably consistent throughout the story. So it's an engaging picture. You actually want to like it a lot more than you do. They lace it with a lot of classical music, starting with The Sleeping Beauty, Tchaikovsky at the Bolshoi. Again, shot on location at the Bolshoi, a lot of it in Budapest and elsewhere. But there's no crackle to the story. That's the ultimate problem. There's no connection between the Lawrence character and the Edgerton character, Dominika and Nate, and therefore you lose that essence, that slight sense of desperation you should get in this East-West Cold War renewed kind of story. And when we get the big revelation as to the infiltrator, the mole, it's kind of a letdown, like we haven't been prepared for it. So there's enough there with her performance and the suggestion of female empowerment through this one character who seems to be in way over her depth, and yet not enough rigor or discipline to the story. One other dimension of the story we have to mention. Charlotte Rampling plays the matron. If you can overact and chew the scenery, Adam, without barely raising your voice, she does it. As the matron of an academy where young men and women in Russia are taught how to use their sexual wiles to manipulate vulnerable operatives whom they may encounter. And this is meant to be an erotic story on one level, and there is nudity and sexuality, but it's not so much erotic as borderline sadistic. It's not a sexy story in that regard. It's kind of chilling. It's kind of ugly at times. And again, I know what the filmmakers are trying to achieve, but I think it defeats the purpose a little bit.
So we're going more Bond villain vixen in some regards, perhaps?
In a way, yes. Yeah. Once again, if you can somehow separate Jennifer Lawrence's characterization from the movie around her and the story around her, it seems a lot better. It wants to be far more topical, far more intelligent than it turns out to be. It's an interesting watch, but it's a good 20 to 30 minutes too long, at 2:15.
So where do you come in on this? Is this worth the dollar, or is this more of a rental?
This is tough. If you're a fan of J-Law, it's worth it. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, rent it.
Okay.
Otherwise, rent it.
So really, I guess we'll put that into the rental category altogether.
Yes.
Then. So that digs us through the film that's out at this point. The big story that folks have been wanting to really dig their teeth into, though, from what I can best tell, is it's Oscar season. We've kind of been priming the pumps on this for what feels like foreverville. And there are a number of categories which we're just going to omit for the sake of time and sanity, such as, honestly, can we just be fair about this? Sound editing versus sound mixing, or sound design versus sound mixing. I mean,
you of all people, Adam.
I appreciate this.
You should care deeply.
I appreciate this. But when we look at the categories and they're almost identical from film to film to film, there's almost no difference. I look at it and I just go, oh, come on.
I appreciate that there is a difference.
I appreciate that there is a difference. I am often disappointed that there isn't a difference in the actual entrance of that category. And usually it just ends up being the loudest, most bombastic thing this year, I believe. Dunkirk is usually, I think, what will be topping that list. Because that's what all people ever remember, is they remember the biggest, loudest thing they heard, and then they select that. They never ever seem to vote what I think would be the fair, honest answer on that.
But at the end of this show, Adam, honest question, honest answer from you, are we going to rate the sound design of Cinema Squabble, this edition?
No, we are not. Okay, let us dig into the actual writing credits first. And so let's start with the adapted screenplays. In the adapted screenplay options, or the nominees, we've got Call Me By Your Name, The Disaster Artist, Logan, Molly's Game, and Mudbound. These are adapted screenplays. What do you think, Steve, what's your initial knee-jerk reaction on possible winner on that? And who do you think is going to win, and who would you like to see win?
Okay, that is going to be a two-part answer here.
Yeah.
James Ivory is a sentimental favorite. We know him from all the Merchant and Ivory productions, all those quality, gauzy British productions of many decades. But here he appears not as a producer, but as a writer. And I think he's going to win for Call Me By Your Name. It's a well-liked and respected film. It's a very sentimental choice. He's been doing well, including most recently with the BAFTAs. Mm-hmm. I think my knee-jerk reaction, as you put it, though, would be Virgil Williams and Dee Rees for Mudbound, which, as I've noted before, is on my short list of five best feature films of the past year. Now, the fact that it's a Netflix production has not exactly helped it during award season, but to me, that's an extraordinary, dense, rich, compelling screenplay. So with all due respect to James Ivory, I would vote for Mudbound.
Yeah, and I think if there's any sentiment to the advertising dollar we've seen behind Mudbound, they've certainly, Netflix has done an awful lot to try and get that film in front of people's, get it to the voters' hands, get it in front of people's eyes, get that name in there. I mean, the union you and I belong into, SAG-AFTRA, I remember seeing ads for Mudbound months before we even saw a screener, months before we saw anything. It was on the back of the industry magazine that we...
Yes, our publications, online communications, and all the rest, absolutely.
Yeah. So they have been working hard at trying to get that that drum beating. But I think you're probably right that that's going to James Ivory, even though all of the above. Sprints, do you have any favorites on that of the adapted screenplays?
No, I think it's going to be between Call Me By Your Name and Mudbound.
Yeah. I would personally like to see The Disaster Artist.
Go ahead.
Well, you're tearing me apart, Lisa. I would love to see The Disaster Artist make a bigger splash purely out of the fact I love the film. I love the history to it. I love the story of The Disaster Artist and The Room and Tommy Wiseau and what Greg Sestero came up with and then subsequently what was put together for The Disaster Artist. I mean, this story of friendship, brotherhood, it's just a lighthearted film. But in the light of all of that's been, you know, hashtag Me Too and all that that's come out about James Franco and what have you, I think it's just kind of gotten into the wash and has been ultimately left by the wayside.
We also respect you as a scholar of the disaster artist.
Right. Yes. Or the room, as it were. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. The source material.
Yeah, yeah. So Call Me By Your Name, I would agree with you. That is probably where we were headed on that. Writing by, or I guess an original screenplay. Here is another film or a series of films that I think we have seen a lot of advertising dollars behind, several of them. Again, one of them being The Big Sick, getting a writing nomination. Also, Get Out, Lady Bird, The Shape of Water, and Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. Those are your candidates for original screenplay. We have seen actually a lot of money behind all five of those. I would say The Shape of Water seeing the least amount of advertising dollar behind it, period, though. Steve, take?
In the writing category. Yes, that is odd, and I would not give it to The Shape of Water, personally, because I think if there is a flaw to the film at all, and we'll get to Best Feature down the road here, I think it's sort of in the way that, tonally, it's awkward from time to time. Speaking of moving from one kind of genre to another, there's some awkward seams in that story in the way it's written. I am fascinated that we have, finally, a woman, again, nominated in this category, an African-American nominated in this category, a comedy nominated in this category, and my choice for winner in this category, which would be Martin McDonagh. Not only, and I freely admit my prejudice, when it comes to writing, it's almost the first detail to which I pay attention with any feature film. Martin McDonagh is a playwright turned screenwriter, an Irishman writing a thoroughly American story. I love crackling dialogue, and this film is loaded with crackling, nasty, intelligent, funny, disturbing dialogue. And the way the story is structured and the way the characters evolve. For my money, it's Martin McDonagh. I thought he was perhaps sold a little short, not getting a Best Director nomination. I think he's going to win in this category.
Yeah, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri on that one, yeah.
Yeah, when you meet somebody, I am more fascinated by when I meet somebody that I don't really know what's going to come out of their mouth. I don't know how they're going to say something. And if it just is a little bit off-center, I adore that person immediately, and that's what this film does to me. I don't always know what's going to come out. You think you know what direction they're going, what they're going to say, but not the case.
Yeah.
I love that.
I would say kind of ditto to all of this, but I saw that same sort of pattern happening in Lady Bird, Greta Gerwig's writing. I found the crackling humor there, the oddball answers, all of that same, from what both of you are saying, the sentiment still applies to Lady Bird. My vote would go to Lady Bird, but I have a feeling you're right, Steve. This is probably going to Three Billboards. Sprint, are you kind of in agreement on Three Billboards as well?
Oh, yeah. Most definitely.
You know, and despite, you know, hey, Big Sick, you wrote a great film, it's funny, and the advertising dollar, we're clearly there for The Big Sick. I just don't think that's going to be the winner when it comes to writing in that regard. Want to move on to some of the other categories, such as cinematography this year. Steve, do you happen to have the list for cinematographers in front of you there?
I do indeed. Shall I give names or just films in this case?
Yeah, why don't you give us both?
Okay, we have Bruno Delbonnel for Darkest Hour, The Churchill Story. Hoyte van Hoytema for Dunkirk, thank you very much. Rachel Morrison, the first woman ever nominated in this category, for Mudbound. Dan Laustsen for The Shape of Water. And the venerable Roger Deakins for Blade Runner 2049. Again, if there's another sentimental favorite in the entire Academy Awards season, alongside our friend James Ivory, it's Roger Deakins. This man has been nominated how many times? 14, 15 times?
It feels like a gajillion times.
Oh my goodness, it's just extraordinary. And I do think, you know what? I'm not the biggest fan of this latest Blade Runner 2049, but the cinematography, the look of the film is just extraordinary. I'm going to have to go with gut and heart on this one and say, Roger, it's your time.
It is, 100%. Do you want to make a bet?
No, I think we're in concurrence here, and the Seattle Films Critics Society, I think, would be backing that as well, out of the fact that Blade Runner 2049 was sort of the big winner when we did all of our voting back in December. That was one of the big runaways, almost, of the actual voting within the Seattle Film Critics Society. So I'm going to back that one as well. I think it's Roger Deakins. I really do think Shape of Water is a beautiful film, and I like what I mean, I had a chance to catch up with Darkest Hour a second and third time over this, you know, 2 weekends ago, so still really appreciate a lot of what we're seeing here, And I appreciate the fact that we're getting a female cinematographer with Mudbound, with Rachel Morrison. So there's a lot to really like about what's in this category, but I think because it has been Deakins and he's not received anything, this is his year. So I'm going to agree with you on all of that. So moving forward, when we start talking about score, Steve, you have the list in front of you.
I do have the list in front of me. And you know what? It's a particularly strong list, just like cinematography. I think we all agreed on that one. Mm-hmm. Johnny Greenwood for Phantom Thread. John Williams, yet again, for Star Wars, in this case, The Last Jedi. Carter Burwell for Three Billboards. Alexandre Desplat, the Frenchman, for The Shape of Water. And Hans Zimmer, another of your favorites, mm-hmm. for Dunkirk, another yeah. epic kind of score with lots of leading cues. May I say this one thing about Hans Zimmer in Dunkirk? I've been wanting to say this for a long time. We may have talked about this when we saw it together, Adam, at the preview last fall. This score, it's classically British, if I can say that. It's so suggestive as a means to accompany Dunkirk. And I was waiting for 2 hours for it to break into full-throated Edward Elgar, one of the most famous themes that Elgar ever wrote, Nimrod from the Enigma Variations, and he waits until the very, very end when Tom Hardy crash lands to give us that theme, that 30 seconds of Elgar. He had me on the edge of my seat just because of the score.
Right, right.
Forget about the evacuation.
I would say I liked a lot of what Zimmer put together for Dunkirk. The one thing that kind of detracted me from it, though, was it felt like a lot of his usual tricks. He wasn't really digging very deep to come up with new and original textures and tones that we've heard with some of his other works that he's put together for, you know, any of the Batman series or even the Sherlock Holmes pieces, where he's really done, you know, he's done some creative stuff over the years. I didn't find the creativity to that one quite as compelling. But still, I mean, good work on his part. It just didn't quite sell me completely on the dream.
Well, I have a split here. I think it's going to be Desplat or Burwell for Shape of Water or Three Billboards. I think Desplat's going to win. He's been winning pretty much all the awards. However, I'm going to stick my neck out on this one. I've now seen Phantom Thread 3 times.
Yeah.
So I'm keeping pace with your Darkest Hour in that regard. Johnny Greenwood's score.
Yeah.
Like the film itself, there's almost an ascetic quality to the storytelling and just the whole aura of the film. It's just beautifully realized, quasi-romantic, mid-20th century kind of a score. Mm-hmm. I loved his discretion. I loved his restraint. Mm-hmm. I loved his choice of instruments and the way he brings out certain solos in the score and isn't afraid of making it discreet, he and Paul Thomas Anderson, right. the director. Personally, my heart says Johnny Greenwood. My intellect, if I can put it that way, says Desplat in this category.
I'm going to go with Desplat as well, but a little bit on Johnny Greenwood's score, because when you and I walked out of the screening for the first time on that, I think Michael Medved was standing next to us as well, and the three of us all kind of just sat there and kind of chewed a little bit on the fat about a number of the piano pieces that we were hearing in there, and you were able to identify a number of the actual clips or the composers that were in there. Do you remember some of them?
There's a little bit of Schubert. There's some Chopin. There's some Mendelssohn. There's a hint of Bach along the way. But again, there's this quality. It's almost an ethereal quality to some of his string writing in particular in this score. And even the fact that some of it keeps coming back in only slightly varied form throughout the story, I found was even more haunting as the story plays out. But yes, he quotes or comes very close to, shall we say, emulating the styles of a lot of major classical composers.
Yeah, and I think that was what was really most impressive to me once I actually started putting it together. And it did take you kind of saying, oh, well, yeah, that was this and this and this. And I was like, oh, my gosh, yes, you are correct, sir.
Do you think the Academy is going to feel the exact same way?
Well, not in the sense that I think Alexandre Desplat is going to win for The Shape of Water.
Yeah.
And why?
Because I think there's beauty to that score. I think there's subtlety to that score. He has kind of a lush quality. He has a real gift for orchestration. Desplat's won before in this category. He has this beautiful gift for exploiting the resources of a full symphony orchestra, and it works so well in Del Toro's movie. I think he's going to win it.
Yeah, it's sort of the way I would say the way Desplat works with Del Toro is the way it works with Danny Elfman and Tim Burton. The two really go hand in hand. In this case, Desplat and Del Toro have really worked well to create sort of that whimsical fairy tale vibe. And they both seem to get each other. And I think that really just adds to the overall picture. And I think that's what folks are going to remember. I think
it's a strong category, though. It really is.
Yeah. why don't we move on to what actress in a supporting role? Because this one seems to me like there are a number of really great hits in here. However, I think there's one standout alone. We've got Mary J. Blige from Mudbound, Allison Janney in I, Tonya, Leslie Manville in Phantom Thread, Laurie Metcalf in Lady Bird, and Octavia Spencer in The Shape of Water. My knee-jerk reaction is this is going to Allison Janney in I, Tonya.
Of course it is.
She's the one, I mean, she won with the SAG-AFTRA or the SAG Award. She won Screen Actors Award. I think
Golden Globe, the BAFTA. Yeah.
I mean,
yes.
She's just taken this one hook, line, and sinker. And from accounts from, I believe, and what even Tonya Harding said is...
She just said
that
Allison depicted her mother perfectly.
Yeah. So I think this is, there's no question this is going to Allison Janney. And I don't think there really can be any other alternative.
I don't think so. Although, once again, if I may, just a quick plug for Leslie Manville. Mm-hmm. She and her ex-husband are both nominated for Oscars this year, as in Gary Oldman for Darkest Hour. Manville and Day-Lewis together in Phantom Thread are just, I mean, you almost chuckle when you watch the film, not because everything they do is funny. Some of it is actually kind of witty. But it's just because they're working so well together. They are so precise, so British, so accomplished, so perfectly attuned. And of course, once again, this is Paul Thomas Anderson's direction. But I was so pleased to see that she snuck into this category because she hasn't been nominated that much this award season. So credit to her. She would be number two on my list, but Allison Janney is just perfection.
So I, Tonya, it is. I think this is. She's just going to take the... It's not even the trifecta at this point. Is there a four? Is there such thing as, I mean, what do we have?
A quadfecta?
Quadfecta?
I don't know.
Does that work? Yeah. I don't know. I feel that's where that's going. Moving on to actor in a supporting role, that leaves us with Willem Dafoe in The Florida Project, Woody Harrelson, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, Richard Jenkins for The Shape of Water, Christopher Plummer in All the Money in the World, and Sam Rockwell, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. Sprints, what are your thoughts?
Sam Rockwell, without a doubt.
Why do you say that?
Again, what I like about his character is it's just a little bit off kilter.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he was constantly keeping me in suspense, surprise. When he came on screen, I got excited. What is he going to do next? Mm. And I like that. Woody Harrelson, predictable. I mean, he did a great job.
And the world of Christopher Plummer didn't really just wow you in the fact that he picked up the role in a matter of days and reshot All the Money in the World and the last ditch effort to try and make anything?
He's an actor with experience. He's supposed to do that.
Okay. All right.
And let's not forget he had previously seen the score because he had considered the part. So this was, I mean, the score, the script.
The script, yeah.
So he wasn't entirely unfamiliar with it. No, I think it's, I agree entirely with Sprint. Sam Rockwell's character evolves and he really helps drive the story along with Frances McDormand. So no disrespect to the other actors here. Richard Jenkins, by the way, I'm not certain it's the most substantial role in the world, but there are times when you talk about really giving an emotive performance in The Shape of Water. He's just off the charts good.
Did you see that the AARP awards Richard
Jenkins?
Are
you implying something?
No. What I'm saying is Richard Jenkins was the winner of supporting actor in the AARP awards, and his response was, "Well, thank you for Sam Rockwell for being so young that you couldn't be in the same category as me for this, because you know this really should be." So I think this is interesting. Richard Jenkins, I think, does a fantastic job as well. The thing that is curious to me is we have Woody Harrelson and Sam Rockwell here. I when I first saw this on paper and I hadn't seen Three Billboards, I kind of looked at that and I thought to myself, that could be a vote-splitting thing. I mean, what happens if you get people voting this way and that way? It could clear the way for someone like Richard Jenkins, maybe even Willem Dafoe. I was kind of saying in jest earlier about Christopher Plummer, I don't think he stands a chance, but he does a fine performance. But I think the fact that we do have Woody Harrelson here and Sam Rockwell, I do have that pause for question that maybe it's enough to split a vote. But I agree. I think this is going to Sam Rockwell.
It deservingly goes to Sam Rockwell if that's the way it plays out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we're not squabbling here. We're all agreeing. But that says something. Now we have to see if we're right.
Well, there is that. But we've also still got a few more categories to get through here before we even actually can say there was no squabbling.
Uh-huh. Okay, go for it.
Yeah. Why don't we move on to the actors in a leading role? And that leaves us with Timothy Chalamet for Call Me By Your Name, Daniel Day-Lewis in Phantom Thread, Daniel Kaluuya in Get Out, Gary Oldman in Darkest Hour, and Denzel Washington in Roman Israel Esquire. I'm going to leave this one. I'm not even gonna try and unpack this one at all, really. I saw this between the slugfest of Day-Lewis and Oldman. I still see that being the case, and I think this one's going to Gary Oldman, because like Roger Deakins, Oldman has been up so many times and kind of come up shorthanded. I think this time, this go-around, this just kind of is his all. This is his year.
And he thoroughly and literally embodies his character, mm-hmm. Winston Churchill in this case. Yes, and it's a shame because Daniel Kaluuya, whom I've seen now, I guess, twice in Get Out, mm-hmm. I mean, he's just note perfect mm-hmm. throughout. But it's just one of those, I mean, in general, I think this was a powerhouse year in all four of the main acting categories. Mm-hmm. I think it's very tough. Look at all the actors who've been left out, mm-hmm. Tom Hanks and others left out of this category. But I agree, it's got to be Oldman. It's a career-defining kind of performance. And you're right, he's generally well-liked, and he's clearly overdue.
Mm-hmm. I think the other thing that I took away from Phantom Thread with Daniel Day-Lewis, when I originally thought this was going to be a slugfest, is this isn't really the most wound-up Day-Lewis performance that we've seen. This is a much more subtle, much more measured performance from Day-Lewis. And to that end, I think a lot of folks aren't probably going to find it as memorable as maybe Bill the Butcher or Lincoln or, you know, I don't know anything else that he's done. Left Foot, anything, My Left Foot, you know, mm-hmm. pick any of them. Sprints, what are your thoughts on this? Where are we coming in on this for you?
We're all agreeing once again.
Really?
Yeah, no.
Come on, squabble with us. Dare you.
Not on this case. We'll try the next one. Let's try actress in a leading role.
Actress in a leading role. Steve, you want to read these?
Actress in a leading role. Meryl Streep for The Post. Mm-hmm. Sally Hawkins, The Shape of Water. Margot Robbie, I, Tonya. Frances McDormand, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. And Saoirse Ronan for Lady Bird.
Mm-hmm. Now, Sprints, I know. Here's the seed I'm going to plant for you.
Okay.
You happen to have a direct relation to I, Tonya.
Hmm? Yeah.
Your cousin, Stephen Rogers, was the screenwriter of I, Tonya.
Correct.
So, what do you think of Margot Robbie? Huh? What do you think of Robbie?
She does a fine job, but I'm not voting for her. No, I don't think she's going to get it.
Do you think your cousin Stephen would like to hear that right now? Do you?
You know, he might actually agree with me. Now, Margot does a fine job, but I mean, you know who my vote.
There's
Frances,
your squabble
again.
Right there.
Yeah. But Frances, mm-hmm. holy moly, again, out of the blue, just I don't know what's going on in her brain, and I'm just waiting for those words to come out, and they do, and I don't expect it, and I love her for that.
Okay. Steve, what are your thoughts?
She's just a powerhouse. The first time I saw the film, I thought, give it to her right now, and I don't feel any differently. And again, I feel badly because I really am more conflicted this year than usual. In any other year, I would say this has to go to Sally Hawkins. Mm-hmm. Again, Margot is great, but Sally Hawkins, to me, is the other really dynamic, stands out from the group performance in this category.
Now, Meryl does a great job, but no, here's the thing. Mm. Meryl's doing Meryl. Mm-hmm. So we've seen it before, but if you really kind of watch her, her expressions, the way she delivers her lines, everything about the character, I was drawn into Meryl. Mm-hmm. But it just follows a typical person where Frances's performance was just off kilter and different and special.
And at times, not meant to be likable.
Exactly.
I will also back the play on Sally Hawkins and the fact that I really did enjoy it. I mean, she's mute for the film, basically, and she's still able to convey everything she needs to do within the framework of her character, and it is still delightful for that very reason. I think she knocks it out of the park. I think Saoirse Ronan's portrayal as well as kind of the wacky teenage girl trying to figure out her own, also beautifully portrayed. But yeah, again, I think it comes down to, I mean, every couple of years, Frances comes out of the dark and she kind of steals all the awards. And I think this is.
So you think that Frances is going to.
Yeah, this is Frances's year. There's no question.
Do you want her to win?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I do. Okay. I think she gets it. But I think Frances also made the very strong point of the fact that there are others that are coming up, the young ones. We got to start paying attention to them. She made that point. And I think that's not to be lost. I think that's a very valid point and something that I think the Academy is really going to have to start paying attention to at some point. So let's move on to Best Director at this point. There are still a handful of things we still have to talk about here. We have Best Director and we've got through Actors, Actress.
Best Feature Film.
And Best Feature Film. So moving on to Best Director, let us talk of the Best Directors. Christopher Nolan for Dunkirk, Jordan Peele with Get Out, Greta Gerwig, Lady Bird, Paul Thomas Anderson, Phantom Thread, and The Shape of Water, Guillermo del Toro. Knee-jerk reactions on this one.
Knee-jerk reaction. Okay, let me give you a knee-jerk reaction. Christopher Nolan for Dunkirk.
Really?
Oh, why?
That he wrangled that story, not only that he wrangled that epic story into a readily believable, compelling, emotional, historical kind of epic, but at the same time, the fact that he had a very specific point of view. Let's remember, this is not a typical war story for anyone who hasn't seen it. Yeah. He wants to get inside the epic. Mm-hmm. He wants to look at Dunkirk from the inside out, not the outside in, the way we normally do it. I so often criticize Spielberg because he gets overly sentimental and to a distraction often in his pictures. When you get the characters of Mark Rylance and Kenneth Branagh and others in Dunkirk, I think they actually make the story a little richer and a little more compelling yet. So that's my knee-jerk reaction here. I don't think he's going to win, but you know what? I keep going round and round on this director's category. Nolan, if I had a vote.
Yeah.
You know what I loved? It was a history lesson this year. Darkest Hour, Dunkirk, same time period.
Well, I think in the last 5 years, we've really seen a lot of British history retold with the King's Speech, Dunkirk. The King's Speech, Victorian Abdul, Darkest Hour. I mean, we could basically assemble... and if you're following along on television, you've got The Crown. I mean, you have all of British history.
And Victoria.
And Victoria. You have all of this on display. I don't think there's anything about American history that reads as interesting yet, at least maybe to us Americans, as it were. My feeling on this is I really like what Greta Gerwig has put together again here. I also really like what Jordan Peele has put together. This is his first foray as a director for, you know, feature film. Did he knock it out of the park? Did he do enough to garner the attention of the Academy? I want it to go to Jordan Peele. I have a feeling this is going Guillermo del Toro.
Agreed.
Yeah. Sprints?
Yeah, Guillermo just for his creativity, although I want Greta to win.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and his vision, no doubt about it. May I interject one other sidebar here?
Yes.
That we haven't discussed yet. Oscar ballots went out February 20th, if I'm not mistaken. We now have a simmering controversy about the origins of The Shape of Water, including a lawsuit that's been filed claiming that the story, basically in substance, was lifted from a 1969 American play about a woman, a cleaning woman, an aquatic character, the Cold War, secret government research laboratory, and a lawsuit has been filed, of course, roundly denied by Del Toro and his fellow screenwriter and the producers of the film. But that's been simmering now for about a week. The ballots went out on February 20th, and I'm just thinking aloud, I wonder how many of these voters, if any, are going to look at that and say, I really like the movie, but ... I don't know. There are a lot of political winds swirling around the Oscars this year. I'm just wondering what effect that might have.
That, I think, is a really good question. Do you remember if this came out in Variety or any of the other trade mags?
Absolutely. It came out in Variety. Yeah.
Okay. So this is something that a lot of the Academy members would have been exposed to. They would have seen this. Because this is, I mean, you're mentioning it to me as the first I'm hearing of this, although I've kind of been a bit of an ostrich lately. So I wouldn't know a lot of what might be the political happenings or changings, as it were. So, okay, that is an interesting sidebar. And someone was asking me just today, what did I think it comes down to? And I was saying Shape of Water or Three Billboards is where this comes to.
Yes.
So why don't we talk a little bit about the Best Picture nominees? We've got Call Me By Your Name, Darkest Hour, Dunkirk, Get Out, Lady Bird, Phantom Thread, The Post, Shape of Water, and Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. Again, I think it's coming down to Shape of Water or Three Billboards. And really, with what you're now telling me, that split down the middle is now even more questioning to me. I don't know.
And you know why I think it's those two, between Shape of Water and Three Billboards? If the other ones are telling a story, just a, I can't say a typical story, but a story that we can follow, these two have just a creative twitch, if you will, again, that puts us a little bit off kilter, and I appreciate that creativity. I'm remembering it sticking with me, and that's why I'm actually voting for those two, even though all the other ones.
Yeah, we got to get you up to speed on Lady Bird too, though, because I think that, again, that does the same thing. It's going to be the When we get you up to speed on that, I think you'll be sitting here going, oh, man, it's a three-way horse race. I don't know.
Okay, then make it a three-way horse race.
Yeah. Steve, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I tend to agree. What's interesting about this is that 7 of the 9 nominees are period pieces this year. Mm. I don't know exactly what that says, but it seems to be more than just coincidence, the way that these directors and these filmmakers have created stories out of the past and made them seem topical again and contemporaneous for us and compelling in our own time. I do think it comes down to Shape of Water and 3 Billboards. Until I saw 3 Billboards the second time, I was convinced The Shape of Water was not going to have any competition in this category. Mm-hmm. It's such a complex, visionary film by Del Toro, mm-hmm. whose work I generally love. I love his whole approach to storytelling and film directing and filmmaking. 3 Billboards, though, I likened it last time, and I think you and Sarah both chided me a bit on it. Mm-hmm. To me, 3 Billboards is still a little bit of the, if not little, littler picture that could.
Yeah.
That has taken a lot of people, I think, inside and outside the industry by storm. I think 3 Billboards is going to win. I think it's just on a roll. To me, the best picture among the ones which are nominated here is The Shape of Water.
Yeah. Yeah. I concur. Sprints, what are your final thoughts on this?
I can't decide.
You can't decide.
Now we have a squabble going.
Okay.
Yeah. You want to kind of influence me? I'm going to say 3 Billboards.
I'm still very torn. Yeah, you're going 3 Billboards.
Let's just put it out there.
Okay.
We can't always agree.
No, we can't. So I guess we will have the I told you so event coming up here in a couple weeks yet when we get Sarah back with us. But in the meantime, there you go. So the jury is out. The jury has spoken. Steve, are you working on any other projects at this point?
I am ramping up film criticism on the new Northwest Public Broadcasting website at nwpb.org. Radio and television merged at the first of the year, and we're just starting to ramp up film and other arts criticism. So I'm taking film in hand, coming up to speed with the likes of Peter Rabbit and Red Sparrow and some other recent releases, Annihilation. And so that's my main in-house project at the moment.
Uh-huh. Sprints, anything for you?
I'm going to continue to produce this podcast.
Sounds like a plan. And, that does it for us. This is Cinema Squabble, episode number 70. Thanks so much for joining us. If you get the chance, click on over to cinemasquabble.com for more episodes, more information, more thumbs up, more stars, more likes. And, we'll see how the Oscars turn out.